you're a print reader, that's something you're enjoying at the weekend. Hopefully you're picking up on our podcast when you're on your commute. You're reading the website when you're out and about. So brands have to think creatively about how they reach their audience where they are. And that's something that we've really tried to focus on.
Welcome everybody to Media Voices, the Media Focus podcast that brings you the news and the views from around the media world. Busy week this week, but before then, Peter, why don't you introduce this week's guest?
And that quote you just heard is from Sarah Orme, digital editor of Immediate Media's In The Moment magazine, and we'll hear more from Sarah in a moment. Get it?
And remember, there is just over a week left to purchase tickets to the Publisher Podcast Awards. So if you head over to publisherpodcastawards.com, you can grab a seat or two. Those of you who aren't lucky enough to have a horse in the race should still follow along at PubPodAwards on Twitter.
This week, because there are so many pieces of news, we're going to be a little bit more structured than normal. So we're going to be going through the news in results, people moves, launches, and then a couple of one-off stories that are kind of interesting as well. So first of all, Twitter has beaten its fourth quarter revenue expectations, topping $1 billion for the first time. Woo-hoo. Shares rose more than 8% on the news. That's incredibly good news from Twitter. Do you remember only a couple of years ago, we were like, where do we go? Where do we go when Twitter inevitably fails?
Well, I think it's that thing that Twitter's been so heavily reliant on ads, and everybody's said, oh, well, you know, ads are declining, so therefore Twitter can't have a really sustainable future. And actually, they seem to be doing pretty well on this.
Yeah, now it's not all good news. So the company said that while international growth was steady, it had been held back by ongoing quote-unquote headwinds relating to its mobile advertising tech and an issue, now resolved, relating to targeting. And I mean, at this point, isn't targeting itself an issue?
The individual engagement of users is going up. So despite Twitter being like a complete cesspool of toxicity and whatever else, people can't get enough of it. They're actually logging in more frequently than they used to, which is good for the long term.
But what about actual number of users? Is that still
it's just plateaued.
And talking of Q4 results, the New York Times has hit a key milestone, passing $800 million in annual digital revenue, with more coming from readers and advertisers. And they've also topped 5 million subscribers. I feel like we talk about good news about the NYT every week now.
Failing news.
Failing, yeah.
New York Times.
Yeah, but so this is great news for the New York Times. We do talk about them all the time, and well done. But
do we talk about them? Serious talk. Do we talk about them too much? Because they are an outlier.
Yeah,
and there's very little lessons I think people can
absolutely
take away.
Because you can't do well. We can't do what they do.
Media Voices crosswords
and recipes. No, they're a global news brand, and they've saved us. So there's a great piece by Emily Bell in the Guardian today. And she talks about, you know, the rise of the New York Times and its reinvention. It's now at a 15-year high in terms of stock. We've got 1,700 staff again in the newsroom. They're doing great. But her point is, well, but these legacy brands, they are outliers. But not everyone can be the New York Times. And she's specifically talking about the BBC. In this quote of the culture secretary, Nicky Morgan, a sentence I never thought I'd say, talking about the BBC shouldn't become Blockbuster. And her point is the BBC should be really wary of becoming Netflix and undifferentiated. And that idea that if everyone tries to be the New York Times or everyone tries to be Netflix or everyone tries to be these success stories, what are we going to end up with?
It feels like all the Q4 results came out this week. We've got all the social media networks that have had various things. So Instagram, which Facebook acquired for $750 million in 2012, generated more than a quarter of Facebook's overall revenue last year. Just a casual $20 billion in ad revenue.
Now that's walking around money.
I'm surprised that was 2012. That feels more recent than that.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but it was only properly integrated a few years after that, which is probably where we start thinking of it being sort of Facebook's Instagram.
And it's only Instagram by Facebook capital letters last year. But I think when it comes to Facebook's bigger picture, the Drum's got quite a good piece on it on this, that their overall growth has actually slowed to 7% in 2019, and they reached, I quote, just 7.3 billion in revenue.
Oh, get out of here with that. I wouldn't let you into the VIP section of my club with that.
I would have the quotes, because they apparently had 61% growth in 2018, so it's been quite a drop. Mm. And apparently one of the big reasons for that is that expenses have ballooned 51% because they're trying to tackle all these privacy issues that have come up. And just to finish off the social media platforms, Snap has grown its daily active users to 218 million, up from just 210 the previous quarter. But it has actually narrowly missed its revenue expectations, which, you know, it doesn't matter how many millions you make, its shares have dropped 9%. So that's all kind of bottoming out now.
Bomber Snap.
Sort of on the other end of the table, YouTube's advertising revenue has been broken out for the first time. And it's the first time that Alphabet has revealed quite how much the video site actually brings in. So for years, people have speculated on this, but now we know that it tops $1 billion a month in 2019. Again, not chicken feed. And actually, considering
these are silly numbers.
Yeah. You know what? To be honest, these stories bore me rigid, because that's not the point, is it? About all the other stuff they're not doing, affects the crap that is on these platforms.
If you were making $1 billion a month, you wouldn't change anything.
These companies, for whatever reason, and I'm sure the people that work at them and run them do have souls, but the companies themselves have become these soulless monoliths. I think it's terrifying. But when we're all in basements eating our own shoes, there'll be no one to go on YouTube because there'll be no electricity and it'll all be screwed. Someone at some point has got to stop this.
Okay, so just whoever had the Peter Talks About the Apocalypse 5 minutes in on the bingo card, you have won. Moving on.
A much more interesting story.
It is, yeah. Why don't you take us through it?
So Vox Media's podcast network generated over $10 million last year. That's interesting. Okay, it's not $1 billion a month, but these guys are doing some interesting stuff. They've got 200 shows across the network, 14 brands. They're really doing some interesting stuff that people care about, and it's not just bullshit bot-produced videos that are going to damage kids' heads.
And this does speak to Vox's, you know, key proposition of broadening out where they exist. You know, they're all across Netflix or all across a bunch of other streaming services.
The other thing that this highlights is how powerful it can be. So a lot of publishers will have a lot of different brands that will launch their own podcasts and do all their own separate stuff. And actually what Vox did was bring it all in and say, we're going to actually keep this as a network. And I know we'll be talking to Global about this in a couple of weeks, but it's the power that if you've got that network, you can work together across all these brands. I mean, 200 shows across 14 brands, that's immense. Mm. And it's if you have that coordinated approach and that coordinated strategy, podcasts are really starting to work for people. Okay, well, that's enough Q4 stuff, I guess. If we have a look at some M&A now, because there's always M&A in media, Spotify's acquired The Ringer, which is their fourth podcast deal in the space of a year. And I think they're looking to boost their podcast capabilities even more. And The Ringer, for those that don't know, is a podcast-centric media company run and owned by Bill Simmons.
And Cards Against Humanity LLC, who are the creators of the popular adult humor-oriented party game Cards Against Humanity, they have bought the satire site Clickhole. Clickhole is a Onion spin-off, and they acquired it from Geo Media in an all-cash deal. Now, this is a fantastic example of a company investing in a publisher with which it actually shares many values.
That's also the sort of thing they would do just for the lols.
No, absolutely they would. So I think it was maybe 2 years ago, Cards Against Humanity, they claimed to have bought a Super Bowl ad spot, and it was just a static shot of a potato, and then they wrote this incredibly long deep dive into what went wrong, which sounds exactly like something you'd read on Clickhole anyway.
Yeah.
So they said, "The problem we failed to anticipate was that sports fans ultimately had trouble making the leap from Super Bowl to potato to Cards Against Humanity. This, instead of asking one person if the ad was effective 70 times, we should have asked, say, 70 people one time."
I'm really confused by all of that.
And moving on to significant people moves. Peter, I can hear you. I can hear you getting ready to talk about this one.
Well, we just want this to be a significant person who's actually moving. That's the point. So George Osborne's future as editor of the Evening Standard doesn't seem so secure. The Guardian has reported that incoming chief executive and former Media Voices guest Mike Suter is set to change the Free Sheets direction after multi-million pound losses at the Title. Now, Here's a more
interesting... So that was the first piece of news.
Yeah, much more interesting. The Times is reporting the former chancellor has had a bust up with the paper's owner, Vignette Lebedev. And the bust up apparently is because the paper... I can't even say that. Because the paper printed an unflattering photo of the owner. And they fall out over some photograph because he didn't look nice or something.
Yeah.
The world has gone nuts.
Nothing about the losses, nothing about the poo emoji, nothing about the Uber stuff or the London 2020 controversy. It's just because it was a bad photo. Yeah, he got in from the wrong angle.
Apple's new service business chief, Liz Schimmel, who joined in mid-2018 from Condé Nast, has actually now stepped down as their News Plus subscription product has got off to a slow start is a polite way of putting it.
Yeah, that would be a polite way of putting it compared to some of the ways I've seen it described.
Yeah.
Oh, but look. They're looking for a notable name from the publishing world to replace her. Chris?
Esther?
Get your CV.
Peter?
Should we put a joint CV in?
The Media Voices team is going to turn around Apple News Plus.
I do have a background in digital apps, so, you know, I'm sure we can do this between us.
And I'm a chancer, so I'll take it.
Yeah, I can tell stories as well as anyone can.
Do you reckon they'd let us work from home?
Yeah.
Oh, we'd have to. I'm not getting out of bed next couple of days with this.
Notable names like us, of course they would.
Well, speaking of notable names from the publishing world, LinkedIn CEO Jeff Weiner stepping down after 11 years, with the deputy Ryan Ruslansky replacing him.
So I think this is actually quite interesting, because if you look at Wired, have got a really good piece looking at what LinkedIn was actually like 11 years ago. And yes, it is a little bit like too inspirational and clickbaity at the moment, but actually
managed
to get it from, which was essentially just an online CV database, to transition to a social network, it's a really, really interesting story.
Do you know why that is? Because Jeff gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my God.
Has a kale smoothie, exercises for an hour, goes to church, then starts work, and then puts all that schedule on LinkedIn so that people are inspired. And
Microsoft bought him and pumped a load of money in.
Oh yeah, that's incredible.
That helps.
It's a kale
smoothie.
Did they
get him a Peloton bike? So this one's quite interesting, I feel. I hate the name, but Verizon Media is launching a new personal finance vertical for Gen Z and millennials called Cache.
Yeah, I hate the name.
But interesting that they see growth in that kind of personal finance vertical. Yeah, a lot of people have been doing this.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, and Vice have been really going hard on this for quite some time. Vice and Refinery29 both actually have been leaning heavily on that kind of, they call it adulting, but it just means, you know, existing in this terrible existence that we do.
Trying to figure out all the stuff that nobody ever taught us, like how mortgages work and tax returns and all that stuff.
Anyone that figures it out, they let me know.
Talking of launches, the BBC has launched a new weekly podcast featuring Emily Maitlis, which will focus on the US presidential election. I assume they've named it after Brexitcast, but it's called Americast.
The segue into this one could equally have been talking of terrible names. You don't need to have cast in the title of every single podcast these days.
But, I mean, is this to fill the gap of Brexit? Like, Brexit cast has ended now, hasn't it? Ended on the 31st.
Yeah, because Brexit's done now.
Yeah, we don't.
Well, it's not,
we don't
though.
Even, no, it's completely Esther, done. Esther, oh, we don't talk
totally
about it anymore.
Done.
Andrea Leadsom says that we don't even use the word Brexit.
We should all
anymore.
Come together, united, behind the basement that we're going to live in, eating our own shoes.
And for those of you who had Peter Mentions the Apocalypse more than 5 times on your bingo card. Moving on, Group 9 media brand Thrillist has partnered with educational travel provider Academic Travel Abroad Inc. to create immersive trips for their readers. Travel is an incredibly, incredibly lucrative vertical, and it makes sense that Thrillist of all people would be doing this. What's kind of interesting is that travel's a great vertical for the grey pound. You know, it's a fantastic vertical if you're targeting boomers. And so there's this kind of niche appeal to younger generations who are looking for slightly more off the beaten track experiences. But you have to really work for their money.
That seemed to be the pitch Thrillist was giving. It was very much like the trips that you wouldn't necessarily like the bit off the beaten track things. Disney Plus has announced very solid early results, even though they're not available in the UK yet. The service has reached 28.6 million paying subscribers already, which is way more than Apple News Plus has got. And it has yet to launch in many major territories, including the UK.
Google is going to have a go at TikTok because that sounded slightly more sinister.
Very aggressive, yeah.
Slightly more sinister than it was meant to. They've launched an experimental social video sharing app called Tangi. What, so many daft names. Which has short 60-second tutorials.
Google knows better than anybody that the kind of the value of a lot of YouTube videos is that they are instructional. So I can see that this would make sense. So did either of the two of you see this bizarre BBC Netflix comparison that started floating around this week? This is after people have been questioning the kind of the validity of the license fee for quite some time now.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, people have decided that Netflix is a good benchmark for that. I want to get back to that.
That's what Emily Bell's talking about in that piece.
The BBC finally, they finally went on the offensive and said, look, the license fee is worth paying for. And they did it with a series of infographics, basically saying, this is what you get when you pay for the license fee, which... It took them way too long to start breaking this out. Yeah. I think the BBC has coasted far too long on assuming that everyone just has this affection for it. And in a world of competitors, that's not going to cut it anymore. Definitely. And as people pointed out, as people quite smugly pointed out on Twitter, oh, I don't see any Netflix reporters at the High Court. Oh, that's strange. I didn't see anybody from Netflix covering any of the local news stories this week. It's like the last way to change people's minds about paying the license fee is to hector them about it. I just thought it was an incredibly... wrong-headed attempt, like response from journalists who said, of course the BBC is worth paying for. Well, unfortunately, you don't have to convince other journalists on Twitter.
Yeah.
You have to convince the public. And being smug about it isn't going to do it.
Maybe we should have a BBC special.
Yeah, we could well have a BBC.
If it'll get it out of everybody's systems and we can just move on.
Well, maybe it would encourage you to pay your frigging license fee as well.
Peter, do you want to do this one?
Yeah, this story's nuts. In a good way, it's nuts. But lobby journalists all walked out this week after number 10 attempted to exclude newspapers that they don't like, basically. And it's just, you know, it's ridiculous. The lobby is kind of selective in itself, but to sort of separate people into, oh, you're good guys and you're bad guys, it's just so fecund Trumpian.
Yeah.
That feels quite common in the US, but it's just that it's just something we just don't do in this country.
It's just awful. No. So for Prime Minister Cummings to be doing this, it's just awful, and the fact that they all walked out together was good.
That is good. That is fantastic. I am concerned that that is not going to last.
No,
that solidarity isn't going to last particularly long. But long may it continue.
Well, at least they did it. I don't think that ever happened in the States, did it? When they kept people out.
Yeah, they kept saying, why didn't we do this? And nobody ever did
no
it.
No one ever done it, so.
Yeah.
Makes you proud to be British. This week I spoke to Sarah Orme, digital editor of In The Moment magazine from Immediate Media. The magazine's grown with a rising interest in mindfulness, and we spoke about the magazine's position as a women's lifestyle title, print production values, and an expanding podcast portfolio. But I began by asking Sarah to tell me about In The Moment.
So In The Moment is a beautiful women's lifestyle magazine. If you see it in the shops, it always has a lovely illustrated cover, which really jumps out on the newsstand. Our primary focus is mindfulness and well-being, and we do that in a number of ways. So we cover actually quite a range of topics in the magazine. So we have a section which is wellness, which is in every issue. We have creating, we have living, which is our lifestyle section, and we also have escaping, which is travel. But we also cover everything from basically nutrition to yoga.
So that lifestyle idea, it's not, you know, lifestyle in some ways can mean, well, fashion or decorating your house, or it can mean whatever, but you've got a very specific take on that, haven't you?
Yeah, so part of our approach is the idea that you can bring mindfulness and well-being ideas into every area of your life. So when, for example, we have a travel feature, it's not just a straightforward, I went there and I did that. It's what you've kind of gained from the experience. And that allows us to cover a really wide range of stuff.
How do you define mindfulness in that context?
So I'd say mindfulness is really about focusing on the present moment and, I mean, as the name suggests, in the moment. I had to get that in. So mindfulness is basically related to meditation. It comes from originally Buddhist ideas. And so what we try to focus on in the magazine is practical ways that you can bring that into your life.
I mean, there's always these things on mindfulness. It's a fad or whatever. It's one of these trendy things that, like Higgy or whatever, and it lasts for a while. But you guys have actually been going for, what, since 2017?
Yeah.
Like 20 issues in?
We're a bit further than that now. We've just published issue 35. So we're going strong, which is good. It is a growing market. So when we launched, there were really only a handful of mindfulness magazines out there. But now if you go into Smith's or somewhere like that, you'll see that there's a whole selection. And it really is a growing area. But it's not just mindfulness. It's also mental health, which is, we know, is a really big topic for our readers. It's what they're really interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of magazines are focusing on that aspect. Whatever magazines it is and whatever the topic they cover, there's always a mental health angle on it, I think, which is interesting.
Yeah, and it's certainly something we see reflected in our digital content as well. So, for example, one of the most popular articles that we have on the website is about loneliness, which seems quite sad. But, I mean, there was a BBC study in 2018 which said actually it's something that particularly affects young people. 16 to 24-year-olds are the most lonely.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really tapping into all these needs that people have and trying to provide practical and expert solutions to them.
Yeah. Interestingly, in your introduction to the magazine, you talked about it being a beautiful magazine. And it is a beautiful magazine. You know, you see it on the shelf and it looks great and it actually feels great. The production qualities are really high. Is that a big part of it? Is that, it's obviously deliberate because there's money being spent on it, but... Did the readers respond to that?
Yeah, they really do. And I think for a lot of our readers, buying the magazine, it is a special treat. And it's something that they will use to give themselves time. So, for example, on a weekend, quite often we'll get people sharing pictures of where they're reading the magazine, where they're enjoying it. It's about taking time for themselves. And as well as being beautiful, we do really pack it with articles as well. So you're getting quite good value for your money and something that's also really beautiful. And I think the appeal of print as well is just that it's so tactile.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's, I think that is part of the appeal.
So as digital editor though, you're not supposed to be saying that. You're not supposed to be talking about how great print is.
Well, it's kind of, I'm very attached to in the moment. It is, I think for me and Kirsty Dewig, the print editor, we both worked on the magazine from launch. So it is kind of my baby a little bit. But I see the way our different touch points that we have for in the moment, they really work together. So the magazine is part of it, social media is part of it, the website, and of course the podcast. And basically these all feed into the brand. So the brand is overarching, and print, podcast, social media, they are just all parts of that.
Do you get any sense that people move between the different elements? So they will read the magazine, but then they'll also go to the website and they'll listen to the podcast. Do you get any sense? Because I remember years ago, people used to talk about Time magazine, and Time.com was seen very separate from the print.
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is some overlap between print and online. So, for example, we get some people, we do cross-promote as well. So we do promote the podcast in the magazine and vice versa. So there's definitely some overlap, and we get people who are really engaged, enthusiastic magazine readers. And actually, I've worked on other magazines and I don't think any of them have been quite as engaged as our In the Moment readers. It's not just that they like the magazine, it's that they really love it.
Yeah.
But equally, we do have, I would say, a separate social media and website audience. And we certainly do get people, for example, who only listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting.
But does that mean you have to do different things in different places, or does it mean you can get away with doing everything everywhere?
Well, we try not to spread ourselves too thinly. So, for example, with the podcast, we kind of make it work as much as possible. We get as much from it as possible. So, for example, when we do an interview with an expert guest, quite often that will form part of a feature in the magazine, or even will be a whole feature in the magazine.
Right.
And then we'll also be directing people back to the podcast to say, look, you've got part of it here, but actually you can listen to even more if you happen to go online.
I think that's one of the beauties of podcasting, is that idea that it's almost like, well, if we were doing just a feature, we would be doing this interview anyway. But you can expand on that and you can take it back to the feature and you end up with two separate things where before it was just, well, here's my notes for a feature.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I know some people, they take it the step further and they video their podcasts as well. Yeah. I think for me, that's a little bit too much.
Yeah.
But certainly you can tie all these things together. And if I'm meeting with a guest in person, then maybe I'll try and do a little bit of video as well if there's time. But it is as well really just extra value for our audience that they're getting the feature and they're getting this wonderful thing where they can listen to the whole interview as well.
Yep, absolutely. I listened to, is it Wabi Sabi?
Yes, Wabi Sabi.
I listened to the Wabi Sabi episode. It was brilliant. I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of what I love about the podcast, actually, is that I get to speak to these really interesting, really well-informed people. And we can cover just such a range of topics. I mean,
so for the benefit of the listeners, in 30 seconds, explain Wabi Sabi.
Oh, okay. Well, if you listen to the episode, she basically starts by saying that even Japanese people find this very hard to describe, and they don't even have really a word for it in their dictionary, but they all have this intuitive understanding of what it means. And I would say it's essentially about accepting life as it is in the moment, so very mindful, but also accepting life's imperfections, so accepting its flaws alongside things that are positive. And there's a lot of nature and seasonality tied into that as well. So they have all these little micro seasons that the Japanese people appreciate, which I found really fascinating.
I love that. That whole idea of accepting imperfection is just brilliant. That's perfect for my life. So I'm on board. Absolutely on
board.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it's just something that I think we quite often try to express as well through our editorial. It's that your life doesn't have to be perfect.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of pressure on people to be perfect and to have everything. But it's kind of about making the most of what you have and maybe, you know, making changes to your habits that can help you to be happier.
So talk a little bit about the podcast in terms of, because you've been doing it for what, 2 years?
Yeah, so we started in, I think it was October in 2017. So it was not too long after we launched the print edition. And for a very long time, we did it monthly. But we found that that wasn't really quite helping to build momentum in terms of listeners. So back in July, we switched to fortnightly, which has helped our following start to grow. Yeah, so basically when we started the podcast, it felt like a really natural continuation of our brand. So we've always tried to be with the magazine really engaging and really informal. And so for us, actually moving into podcasting felt like a natural progression because it's, as a format, what I really love about it is that it can be so intimate and so personal.
Yeah.
And it does also make our audience feel like they're getting to know us a bit as well, yeah. The people behind the magazine. And everybody on the team is also really enthusiastic. So it's great to have that come across in a podcast form.
So when you're doing the production of the podcast, who does it? Is it always you or is it just whoever happens to be talking to the most interesting person that month or week or whatever?
Well, it is mostly it's me. That's mainly just because it's something I'm very enthusiastic about. So yeah. I'm always keen to do it. And Kirsty is often very busy on the print edition, but certainly it's I want to encourage other members of the team to do it as well. But in terms of production, initially I was doing all of it. So I had to source the interviews, do all the research. I was editing it, everything. We now do have a really great audio team at Immediate who thankfully have taken the editing side off me. So that actually has made things a lot easier and much more efficient, which means I can do more interviews, which is great. I think eventually I probably would like it to be weekly, but at the moment I don't really have the resources for that to happen.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. Immediate had set up a team of people, however many of that is, two or three people, that will take care of the edits for other magazines?
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a central audio team here, and they have launched some very successful podcasts. So they've got BBC Good Food with Tom Carriage they've launched recently, which has been really successful. And there's existing podcasts that we have, like History Extra, which is really successful. But it's also allowing teams to launch new ones as well, which is perhaps they wouldn't have had the capacity to do it before But now that we have an audio team, that's opening up a lot more possibilities.
I mean, obviously, we're big fans. We love podcasts. We've got the podcast awards, which you guys are in. The idea there that magazine publishers like Immediate, you know, Immediate's what, 1,500 people? It's a big company. Are actually taking it seriously enough to put a team together, I think is absolutely brilliant. I love that.
Well, if you look at the figures for podcasting, I don't have any to hand, unfortunately, but audiences are growing just at such a phenomenal rate. I think it's really actually important for brands now to think about podcasting if they haven't done so.
So you're getting like, well, sort of central management, are they encouraging podcasts? Are they talking about it? Are they saying you should be doing this or you could be doing that?
Yeah, so I think some of it is driven by the brands themselves who are coming up with their own ideas for podcasts. And certainly the podcast team what we have here are very proactive in trying to get brands to start podcasts as well. But increasingly, we're also seeing interest from advertisers. So we're now getting people approaching us saying, with an interest in our audience, because it is so targeted and so niche, and you know that you're reaching really engaged people.
So what are the objectives for In The Moments podcast? Is it a reader objective, or is it a revenue objective, or is it both?
It's kind of a bit of both. I think initially it was to engage more with our existing audience, but there's always the hope that we're going to reach a wider audience as well. And certainly that's something we've been working on, and we're looking at more at doing more marketing as well to reach a larger audience. But in the terms of getting sponsorships, that's definitely something we're looking to do more of, and to collaborate with other brands as well. So we have, for example, done a bit of collaboration even within Immediate itself. So we've done a bit of an episode swap with BBC Countryfile, who have a really lovely podcast, if you haven't listened to it. It's the Plodcast, which is where the editor Fergus goes out for a walk. It's very relaxing, very mindful. It's got a very soothing voice. I recommend listening to that one if you're a bit stressed. So we did do, for example, a guest episode with them where we went for a nice mindful walk in the Forest of Dean, which was lovely.
Oh, brilliant. Is that something, because the mindfulness or well-being portfolio Immediate's, well, it's significant. You've got, 12 magazines that could be considered sat in that sort of space. Do you work together quite a lot?
I would say within Immediate, there is quite a collaborative atmosphere just overall. And so, for example, in the past, we've done things like we've worked with BBC Good Food. We've had a wellness week last year, which was very successful. We do collaborate actually quite a lot with BBC Countryfile because there is this lovely overlap of mindfulness and nature. So, I mean, and we're certainly looking at doing other collaborations within the business as well, because I think the really great thing about mindfulness and mental health is that it does really cover everything. It relates to everything. So for us, it's really, you know, we can really work with anybody, which is great.
Yeah, I guess it's about the attitude you bring, isn't it? It's not necessarily what you're doing.
Yeah, and we've been quite proactive and going out there and going to other brands and saying, can we do things together? Since we only launched in 2017, we're still fairly new. So brand awareness has always been part of our strategy.
I mean, one of the things that I find interesting, if you could you talk about In The Moment as a women's lifestyle magazine?
Yes.
And then I look at, you know, the broader women's magazine market, and it's taken a bit of a beating. You know, magazines like Marie Claire closing down last year. But you guys in magazines like you in the craft sector and whatever, the specialist women's magazine, magazine market, if you like, is actually doing better. Why do you think that is?
I think that's an interesting question. I think perhaps people's interests are shifting, as I said, towards more mental health awareness in particular. I mean, there's figures, what is it, 1 in 4 adults experience mental illness in their lives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think as well, people are starting to be more open about mental health. And I think that has really helped our sector to grow. But I think one thing that has helped us is just focusing on reaching our audience where they are. So, for example, you know, if you're a print reader, that's something you're enjoying at the weekend. Hopefully you're picking up on our podcast when you're on your commute. You're reading the website when you're out and about. So I think brands have to think creatively about how they reach their audience where they are. And that's something that we've really tried to focus on.
Yeah. Also, I think having an angle, you know, you're approaching lifestyle from a very specific point of view.
And I think one of the things that's gone on in the women's magazine markets, and I think what's killed the men's magazine market, is actually that idea that the point of view is being a woman or being a man, which isn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, and I'd certainly say, I mean, our audience is almost overwhelmingly female, even online. But actually, it's quite interesting looking at our podcast stats recently. I was having a quick look on Spotify before this interview, and actually we're getting a growing number of men, which is right. quite interesting, who are listening to the podcast. And certainly with our website, maybe a third of our readers are men, because I think the topics that we're covering are so universal. So, yeah. For example, we always see sleep topics do really well. And the World Health Organization has said that there is a sleeplessness epidemic.
Yeah.
So sleep is always really performs well. And obviously men are reading that as well as women. Yeah. Stress as well is another big topic. For quite a long time, one of the most popular things on our website was a quiz, which was, am I stressed? And I think if you need to take the quiz, you probably already are. But I found that quite interesting.
That's a brilliant. If you need to take the quiz, you're stressed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go back to the sleep thing. I know you've got a new project coming up.
Yes.
Go on, talk about that, the sleep podcast.
Yeah, so I'm very excited about this. So basically, we were talking to one of our sister websites, At Immediate, Made for Mums, which is a parenting website. And we recognised that there was a gap in the market, basically, for mindfulness in their sector. And one of the key problems that parents have, I think most parents have this, is getting their children to go to sleep. And so we had a bit of a look online. And while there's quite a few sleep meditation or bedtime story kind of podcasts out there, at the moment, there wasn't really anything that specifically related to children and getting children to go to sleep. So we decided we would launch this podcast called Sleepy Time, which is going to be coming out on 16th of February.
Wow.
And for that one, we've worked with our experts from In the Moment that we work with all the time and we know really well. So we've got Susie Redding, who's an author and she's a psychologist, and she's actually written books on mindfulness for children. So she's got real expertise in that area and she has created these really lovely scripts for us. And then we've worked with a local mindfulness and meditation teacher called Gemma David. She has narrated them for us and she actually has a really lovely soothing voice. Actually, when we were recording them, I was trying not to nod off in the studio.
I was going to say, these work for adults as well.
Absolutely, it will work for adults. It worked Excellent. On me. She just has the most perfect voice for it. So I think that's a really great example of the kind of creative collaboration that we do a lot with In Immediate, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, that sounds brilliant. Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
As a digital editor, do you still put content out on social platforms or on digital magazine platforms? Do you actually distribute your content through third parties?
Yes. So actually one app that we do work with quite a lot is Flipboard, which I think you've had on your podcast before. And so we quite often pitch to their editorial team. So we pitch features that they might want to feature. Sometimes magazines, which are essentially collections of articles.
Yeah.
So, for example, we've got one coming up this month with them, which is all about positive thinking, which I think everybody needs in February. Yeah,
definitely.
So that is one that we work with particularly closely. Of course, as well, we do have our digital editions. We're on Apple News as well. Yeah. So we do cover our bases, really.
Yeah. The Flipboard one's interesting because it's kind of under the radar. You know, no one really talks about it that much. But
yeah, we're very proactive with Flipboard. And it has been really great for us because a lot of our content actually is really evergreen. And it's things that people really relate to. So one we had recently that did really well was how to stop comparing yourself to others, which I think is something a lot of people struggle with. And of course, sleep articles perform really well.
Yep.
So a lot of the stuff that I pitch to them would be the more universal kind of topics.
Yeah. And does it drive traffic back to your websites or?
Yes, it does. So it is quite a good source for us of referral traffic. Because I'm sure you know with Apple News, we don't really get a lot of referral traffic from them because they literally pull in the whole article. And then there's no reason for people to come back to our website. Whereas with Flipboard, when people click on an article, it's taking them straight to our website, which right. is a really great way to get more referral traffic.
Oh, interesting.
Wrapping up, we always ask our guests if they can suggest or recommend some piece of media that they've absolutely loved. Have you got anything?
Yes, and of course, because I'm a complete podcast addict, it is a podcast. So one I've been listening to recently and really enjoying is a podcast called You're Wrong About, which is presented by two American journalists, so Sarah Marshall and Michael Hobbs. And what they like to do in their podcast is to look at old news stories that you think you know and basically delve into what really happened. So, for example, one of their ones which I really enjoyed was, did Yoko Ono really break up the Beatles?
Oof.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot to delve into on that one. And they also had a really great two-parter on the ice skater Tonya Harding, which I'd also really recommend.
Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of Media Voices. If you'd like to stay in contact with us or abreast of everything we're doing throughout the week, you can visit our website, which is voices.media. While you're there, you may as well sign up to our weekly newsletter, which includes a link to the latest episode, a curated list of everything we've been reading around the web, and links out to some articles we've written for various publications. Sign up for that by going to voices.media.
And all those stories we've discussed this week, that mammoth list, if you want to get them in real time, you can follow us on Twitter at Media Voices Pod, where we basically post all the media news, views and opinion that we find interesting. So follow
and
us.
And some that we don't actually find interesting, but we think it's worth sharing. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back again next week with another wonderful guest and another news roundup. Until then, have a brilliant week. See you soon.
Bye.
Goodbye.